Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the elections in Germany, with the results just coming in, and speak with Daniela Schwarzer, Director of the German Council on Foreign Relations. She joins us from Berlin to discuss Chancellor Angela Merkel's victory in winning a fourth term, with her Christian Democratic Union winning 32%, with the Social Democratic Party at 20%, and the far-right Alternative for Germany gaining 13.3%. We'll explore the likelihood of Merkel forming an alliance known as the Jamaica Coalition because of the party's colours resembling the Jamaican flag, comprising Merkel's CDU, the pro-business Free Democratic Party, and the Greens. Then we'll examine further the important political role of Angela Merkel on the world stage, where she is increasingly being referred to as the leader of the free world, a title normally assigned to the President of the United States. But because of Trump's disdain for America's longstanding alliances and his growing unpopularity at home and abroad, the role the U.S. has had since the end of World War II is being relinquished. Joining us is Charles Kupchan, who up until recently was a special assistant to President Obama for national security, and before that was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, and is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Then finally, we'll speak with veteran sportscaster Robert Lipsight, a longtime sport and city columnist for the New York Times and the author of a memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, who is also a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for NBC Nightly News. He joins us to discuss the fight that Donald Trump has picked with some of the country's biggest stars in football, basketball, and baseball, and Trump's excessively macho contention that NFL football is not rough enough at a time when the debilitating effects of CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, among professional footballers is becoming known. For the New York Times and the author of a memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, who was also a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for NBC's Nightly News, he joins us to discuss the fight that Donald Trump has picked with some of the country's biggest stars in football, basketball, and baseball, and Trump's excessively macho contention that NFL football is not rough enough at a time when the debilitating effects of CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, among professional football players is becoming known. And joining us now is Daniela Schwarzer, Director of the Europe Program at the German Marshall Fund and a Senior Research Professor at the Department of European and Eurasian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She is the co-founder and co-editor of the European Political Economy Review and Eurozone Watch EU website. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniela Schwarzer.
Hello,
Daniela. And I believe now that you're the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations as well.
So that's correct, yes.
So I'm sorry that perhaps that slightly out-of-date bio. But in terms of being up-to-date, what are the latest figures in terms of the elections? The ones that I read out, are they standing at the moment?
Yes, so things are still slightly moving because votes are being counted. But what you said is correct. The CDU comes first. The SPD, the Social Democrats, have an historically low result. Actually, their worst result ever, with somewhere between 20 and 21%. And the news of the day definitely is that a far-right party, Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, is making it into the parliament for the first time on the federal level and will probably end up having 13 to 14% of the votes. So this is new, and I think the news of the day is not only that this party made it in, but also that the Liberals, who have been absent from the German parliament for 4 years, came back. That is definitely good news for democracy in Germany. And so we will have a parliament with six parliamentary groups. And we see that the two historically major parties, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, who used to have a very large share of the seats, will probably only ending up with around 52% of all seats in the parliament. So fragmentation is the issue of the next parliament.
Well, who comes in third is key. And given that the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, for Germany, the far-right party, they're obviously celebrating, and one of their leaders, Alice Weidel, is threatening to investigate Angela Merkel for letting in a million refugees into the country. So to what extent was this election a referendum on Germany's approach to dealing with the influx of refugees from the Middle East?
I believe to a much lower extent than many people think and say today. There was obviously some polling done throughout the day, and people were asked what determined your vote today. And interestingly, one of the major TV stations just issued a poll that shows that only 27% of voters actually said it was migration and immigration. But people are much more interested in issues like education, for instance, economic and social cohesion. These are topics that made them vote. And then there is another poll out, which I think says a lot about why AfD was voted, this far-right party. And that is not because people think they have a good program, but essentially because they wanted to show their frustration with the moderate parties. So basically only 20% of the voters said today they voted for AfD because they liked their positions. And the rest said, we just wanted to cast a protest vote. And this, you know, I think is very much related to the coalition government we have had for the past 4 years. It was a so-called grand coalition, meaning the two major parties, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, formed this government. They didn't disagree on much, and the opposition was fairly weak in political terms. So Germany has gone through another 4 years of relative political calm and not much of a discussion domestically. So the vote today, I think, to some extent has to be interpreted as a vote against this very, very broad political consensus, and it stirs up the system, it stirs up the parliament, and we are heading for 4 years with a parliament that will be much more controversial. And even though it would, of course, be preferable not to have a far-right party sit in the German parliament, in terms of democracy and debate, this is going to be an interesting and controversial and probably sane situation for our party system.
So that's what commentators mean when they say that cozy Germany is over.
That's absolutely true. Chancellor Merkel will now form a new government after having been in office for 12 years. And her political style has been a very calm one. She has steered Germany through moments of crisis and real challenges, some of them related to Europe, some of them related to international affairs, and some definitely related to immigration. But the political mood and the political climate in this country is really somewhat calm, and some have argued too calm and almost suffocated because political controversy was very weak. And so this election definitely changes the situation. It will be very interesting to observe how the far-right party will behave in parliament. Their tone in the electoral campaign has been extremely, obviously controversial, but I would say to some extent politically not correct. They will obviously have to abide by the rules that govern German democracy. They will have to respect the standards, and we will see still, even if they do that, that there will be more controversy within the German parliament, and the government will have to justify its decisions to a much stronger degree than was the need over the past 4 years.
So let's talk about the so-called Jamaica coalition, of the idea that the union, the governing coalition, now, given the results of this election, would mean that Merkel's CDU would be joining with the Free Democratic Party, the pro-business party, and the Greens in a coalition that resembles the colors of the Jamaican flag. Is that what you foresee, Daniela?
Well, that's the likely scenario, because the only other arithmetic option we have on the table tonight would be another grand coalition, including the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, so Merkel's CDU and the SPD. But SPD party leader Martin Schulz has already ruled out that option. He said his party would go into opposition and lead the opposition in the German parliament. So the only option with moderate parties that is on the table at this point is the one you mentioned, meaning a three-party coalition including the Christian Democrats and the Greens and the Liberals.
So the idea though that the AfD came in third, the far right party, and of course there's been a kind of taboo in Germany of this ethno-nationalistic kind of ideology. So how is it being handled? Is it creeping back? I mean, there are laws that against I think even referring to people as Nazis. Is that, am I correct in that? Because I think one of the leaders did refer to the AfD as a Nazi party. So obviously it's a very sensitive issue.
Yes, of course there are right. There are laws that govern what parties can, well, what parties are admitted in the first place. And according to the German law, you cannot have a party which is undemocratic or which denies the Holocaust or which refers to itself as a Nazi party. So the party will be under very strong scrutiny, both with regards to its own constitution and its own bylaws, but then also with regards to its political behavior on the political stage in Germany. I guess what we can anticipate today is that the political culture and the radicalization of the debate will change because of its presence in the Bundestag, but we have very clear principles and standards to what is politically acceptable and what is legally acceptable, and this will very surely be enforced.
So in terms of rhetoric during this election, was there any effective rhetoric? I mean, Merkel apparently has just addressed the nation and has said that she would like to win back the AfD voters.
She said exactly that. And then she gave a list of topics that she thinks are relevant to AfD voters. First of all, it has to be seen that part of the vote, and I would say the larger part of the votes cast for the Alternative für Deutschland, was a protest vote, not so much because the party is convincing, and poll data shows that the party commands relatively little trust on key issues that interest Germans. So it was to a large extent a protest vote, so the major other parties will have to show that they are more responsive to citizens' interests and concerns, and Merkel gave that list today when she said she wants to win back the votes from AfD, and she mentioned, for instance, social cohesion, she mentioned economic progress in Germany, she did mention immigration, but she did not fall back behind her previous positions where she continuously said that Germany has the right to asylum and will continue to be an open country. Of course, and that she said tonight, Germany will continue to fight illegal immigration, but she does not withdraw from the position that there should be no upper limit to refugees who are accepted as such. So she keeps this rather liberal stance on immigration.
So my understanding is that Donald Trump played a significant role in the German election, in as much as everybody seemed to run against him. Was that the case?
There has been some extent of, let's say, criticism of Trump, which kind of blended into some anti-American tones more generally, mostly on the left side of the political spectrum. But the majority of parties and the tone in the debate remained transatlanticist. The reason being that Germany knows the extent to which it really depends on solid and good transatlantic relations, both in economic terms, in terms of trade, in terms of investment mutually on both sides. Many jobs in the U.S. depend on German investment and the other way around, but also in terms of security and the importance of NATO. So there was, you know, no major party campaigning for, you know, any alternative to this transatlantic link. But people are very conscious of the fact that the current U.S. president is incalculable to German policymakers, that many people are very worried about the policies, the international policies he actually wants to implement. So with that happening, Europe has gained importance in the German debate. And the question now is, once the new government is formed, how Germany wants to bring forward European integration, how it wants to strengthen the EU, but not as an alternative to the transatlantic relationship, but much rather to be stronger in this relationship and actually to then rebuild and strengthen the transatlantic partnership.
So is there any concerns in Germany about the big Russian exercise, Zapad, that's going on in Belarus in the context of Donald Trump on repeated occasions, almost reluctantly endorsing Article 5 of the NATO treaty, the collective defense article of the treaty? He's sort of had to do that. He's obviously failed to say it on very important occasions. And when he has said it, he said it with some reluctance. So is that a kind of, does that make Germany and other NATO countries nervous?
It did, and the endorsement that at some point came was greeted with great relief over here in Europe. Russia, of course, is a tricky issue, not only for Germany, but in particular also for other Central and Eastern European countries who are very worried about the violation of Ukrainian sovereignty and territory with the annexation of Crimea. That goes back to early 2014. Europeans are very aware of the fact that strategy that Germany and Europe embarked upon vis-a-vis Moscow in this dispute over Ukrainian territory was really relying on a very close partnership and coordination with Washington, D.C. So the whole sanctions regime that was put in place in coordination between Europe and the U.S., is one example, but then also the negotiations with Moscow and Kiev over the situation in Ukraine, which was conducted mostly by Germany and France, but which was backed by other EU partners and the United States. This was really a coordinated strategy. So it is obvious that the doubt that Donald Trump raised about his own approach towards Russia and also his approach towards NATO, which he now at some point clarified, this was seen as a big risk from the European perspective.
Well, just in closing then, what's your sense of how this coming in third of the AfD, the far-right alternative for Deutschland, for Germany, put it in the context, if you will, Daniela, with the Brexit vote, with Donald Trump's support for both Brexit and for Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader in France, and, of course, Wilders in the Netherlands. Is there would this indicate in any way that that constituency is growing? Or is it because it is in some ways tied to Donald Trump? Does his popularity actually diminish the effect of the far right?
Well, first of all, Germany is to some extent part of now a broader European trend, which means that there are far right parties which are outrightly EU critical and which try to convey an alternative model of pulling a country out of the European Union that can sort of thrive without Europe, just like UKIP and to some extent the pro-Brexit Tories did in the UK. But in Germany, this is not shared by any other parties. So even the Alternative for Deutschland doesn't really say Germany should leave the EU. They are critical of the euro and they say some things within the currency union are not working well. But I would say that this party was definitely fed by those trends in other EU countries. Now, Donald Trump, he basically supported Brexit rhetorically. He said, well, this might be a good idea to regain sovereignty. But this was seen really from the German perspective of first of all, an interference within the EU affairs, and then also as a very short-sighted view because the EU, as it stands with a single market, with a single currency, and also with the political integration it has also in terms of security and the projects that need to be built to complete it, this is really a big guarantee of stability for all EU members. So while I would say that the style of Donald Trump and his electoral campaign definitely fed or inspired the way AfD also conducted its own campaign, and others in other countries may be copying this. His political interference into the debate in Europe on the question of whether it makes sense or not to stay in the EU, in my view, did not affect AfD's success in Germany today.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniela Schwarzer.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who joined us from Berlin. She is the director of the German Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining further the important political role of Angela Merkel on the world stage, where she is increasingly being referred to as the leader of the free world.
Well, he says he's got a big boat with a high rope.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Charles. And what did you make of the election results in Germany, where it does appear that there will be what they're calling the Jamaican coalition of Merkel's CDU forming a coalition with the pro-business Free Democratic Party and the Greens? But the key vote, of course, or the one that everybody was looking at, the people who came in third, the alternative for Deutschland, the far-right party, they've gained about 13.3%. So let's begin with that. Is that alarming, or how does it strike you?
Well, you know, I think there are two diametrically opposed ways to interpret the election. One is that it was an earthquake of sorts because for the first time since World War II, you have a far-right, anti-immigrant, nationalist party in the Bundestag, and the CDU and the SPD, the two main center-right and center-left parties, did very poorly, as badly as they've done since World War II. And so you could say, you know, whoa, what's going on here? Things are moving in a worrying direction. On the other hand, you could also say that the center has held, and that's because even though AfD got 13.2.3%, they're not going to be in the government. The next government, as you put it, is likely to be a Jamaica coalition with the Free Democrats and the Greens. It's still possible, I think, even though the Social Democrats said no thank you, that you could see a grand coalition. So the bottom line is that center-left and center-right have shrunk in terms of their share of the vote, but they still are in control. And so I don't think we'll see any major changes in German foreign policy, in part because Merkel has already moved to the right on immigration to steal the march from AfD. So yes, they're a new force in German politics. Should we all head to the basement because extremist nationalists are coming back to power in Germany? No.
So when the SPD leader, Martin Schulz, says that this election has been a difficult and bitter day for German social democracy, what's going on in terms of these traditional parties in Europe, particularly the socialists? They seem to be falling apart. They certainly fell apart dramatically in France with the center right coming out of nowhere under Macron and wiping out the socialists. And it's not entirely a wipeout. They're about 20% of the vote, but they're clearly not doing well. Yeah, what explains that phenomenon? Is that in terms of the broader context of Europe itself?
Well, you know, the center-left in Europe has traditionally come from what we Americans would consider the far left. Socialist, very ambitious and broad welfare state, very strong unions, very ambitious labor law. And over the course of the last couple of decades, the center-left has been divided, if you will, between those who have moved to the center. Tony Blair, in some ways, was the guy who took the British Labour Party, Britain's Social Democrats, to the center. The same thing happened in Germany under Gerhard Schroeder, meaning that there wasn't much difference between Social Democrats and Christian Democrats. But now, because of immigration and because of deindustrialization, socialists are having buyer's remorse. And some of them are tacking back to the far left. Some of them are staying in the center, but they are right now a very divided party. Probably the best example of that is what's happened in the United Kingdom, where the head of the Labour Party, Mr. Corbyn, comes from a very serious socialist background. He has moved Labour very far to the left and in some ways into the wilderness. So generally what's happening is that center-right parties are doing reasonably well, enough to be in power in most European countries. Center-left is deeply divided, but the good news is that together, center-left and center-right are holding the governments. And that's why, with the exception of the UK, which is heading toward Brexit, Poland, Hungary, where you have populist parties in power, the situation is generally positive. And I think that, and you were talking with Danielle a little bit about this, Europeans have looked at Brexit, they've looked at Donald Trump, and they've said, no, thank you. And that has, to some extent, re-legitimated the political center.
So when I mentioned in the opening, Charles, that Angela Merkel is becoming more and more referred to on the world stage as the leader of the free world, a title normally assigned to the President of the United States. But it does seem that Donald Trump's disdain for America's longstanding alliances and his growing unpopularity at home and abroad has resulted in the U.S. to some extent relinquishing the role it's had since World War II. Do you think this is terminal, or could this be reversed if Donald Trump doesn't, let's assume that he doesn't run a second time, or if he does, he gets defeated.
You know, I'm hoping it's terminal. Having lived through the re-election of George W. Bush and the election of Donald Trump, I'm sort of skittish about being optimistic on American politics. But on the other hand, it seems to me that even though Donald Trump has maintained his base, he's losing moderate Republicans, he's losing the political center, and I'm guessing he will continue to govern in an erratic and an extremist way, which will make it difficult for him to be reelected. And so the question I ask myself is, how much damage will be done between now and the next election, when I hope the United States comes back to the reasonable center on many issues? And can Merkel, working with Macron, the French president, and others, hold down the fort while the United States is missing in action? And, you know, we don't know the answer to that. Part of it depends on the decisions that Trump makes on North Korea and on Iran and a whole bunch of other issues. But you do have a situation now in which the two countries most responsible for building the Western world, and they are the United Kingdom and the United States, beginning around 1815, are backing away from that world. The UK because of Brexit, and the United States because of a Donald Trump who has decided, or who believes that He represents a sector of the American electorate for whom the world erected under Pax Americana is not a good deal. And so he's coming out with a big wrecking ball, and Merkel and her fellow travelers are going to have to try to prevent the damage from being grievous.
But have you figured out, and I certainly haven't, what is the strategic logic of people like Trump? Well, let's assume that that people like Bannon might well be more important in the sense that they have shaped his policies, if that's how you can describe them. Bannon, of course, being the chief strategist up until recently. Incidentally, he played an important role in Brexit along with Robert Mercer, his political patron, mm-hmm. who's also the biggest donor to Trump's campaign. And they also played an important role in the last election through Cambridge Analytica, a company and whose activities are still being looked at, particularly in the context of these controversies over Facebook. I, for the life of me, cannot understand what their policies are, what their vision is. For example, in Bannon's case, he was recently meeting with the right-hand man of President Xi. He's still out there, you know, being treated as an important person because of his ties to Trump. Apparently, they talk on the phone a lot. And here he is talking about how the Chinese, we've got to stand up to them, they cheat, et cetera. They don't play fair, and we're at the cusp between whether the United States will be the global leader or China will take over. Well, what was the first thing these guys did was get rid of the TPP, which was an arrangement that Obama had made, not so much to contain China, but to organize the neighborhood, in terms of free trade, so that China would have to play by the rules. It right. doesn't make any sense. So have you been able to figure out what these guys stand for? Or are they just bomb throwers and anarchists and wanting to destroy the administrative state or whatever it is that Bannon promised?
I think that many of us thought that it was Bannon that was the problem, and then he left, and now it's Steve Miller, who's the president's senior advisor and speechwriter, who's the problem. But I think, we have to face up to the reality that it's Trump that's the problem, and that the speech that he gave at the United Nations at the beginning of the week was indicative of a president who believes that we live in a world in which hard, self-regarding nation states should go about looking out for their own interests at the expense of everyone else. In other words, he kind of sees the world in zero-sum terms, a little bit like he's out there in New York City building apartment buildings. And if one company's up, another company is down. And the problem is that if every country in the world went out there and essentially mimicked America first, so it was America first, China first, France first, Germany first, where would we be? We'd be back in the Middle Ages, where countries simply didn't give a damn about anyone else. And what happened? Well, we had constant wars, constant bloodshed. And the magic of the post-1945 world is that the United States didn't put itself first in the sense of seeking short-term advantage. It invested in the long term, right? The American taxpayers spent a lot of money on the Marshall Plan, rebuilding Japan, rebuilding Germany. Why? Because they knew that if Germany and Japan in the long run emerged as stable democracies, it would work to our advantage. We now have a president who doesn't understand that. He wants to pull down TPP. He may pull down NAFTA because he says, okay, is this good for us in the next 24 to 36 hours, as opposed to what's the long-term implication of the United States leading the world and trying to build allies that in the end of the day will band together in the service of prosperity and peace? So I think he just, I don't think he gets it, quite honestly.
Well, I'm not sure, though, about, others in terms of the Republican states, particularly in terms of, for example, we were talking with Daniela about the importance of trade, Germany being the world's engine of trade,
yeah.
a very successful economy, Of course, they are a social democracy. They have unions that represent on all the boards of the major corporations. And my understanding is, for example, in the fight down in Tennessee in Chattanooga that just took place over Volkswagen unionizing, the German company are perfectly comfortable with having unions. They're used to it, and they were all in favor of it. But the political establishment in Tennessee and Senator Corker, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and others have basically said we can't allow these plants to be unionized because it stops us from having the ability to attract factories to our state on the basis that of cheap labor. So how do you explain that paradox that under the Marshall Plan, the U.S. effectively established social democracy in both Germany and Japan, but elements within our country are hostile to that notion?
You know, I'd say that it really reflects the very different political cultures that exist in Germany and the United States. Germany has, since World War II, and actually going back earlier, had a very strong tradition of labor and management working together. So you have workers on board, you have alliances across different sectors of industry that you would never see in the United States. And so there is a different notion of what constitutes a social compact. And one of the reasons that AfD has done reasonably well, but not really well, and that Merkel is still in office, is that Germany has this tradition of labor and management working together. It has a tradition of what's called the Mittelstand, which refers to relatively small companies owned by families that have been able to prevent deindustrialization because they have apprentice programs and they represent relatively high-end manufacturing that you can't move offshore because it has sophisticated machine tools, sophisticated technology. You need trained individuals. So the Germans have figured out how to maintain a strong living wage for manufacturing sector workers in ways that the United States has not. And as you put it, Ian, we live in a country where that kind of industrial policy, that kind of state-led growth, is anathema to many, but we're paying the price for that because we're dealing with a country in which a very significant swath of the American electorate, even if they have jobs, is not earning a living wage.
And they, in large part, voted for Donald Trump, did they not?
They did, and they did because they're unhappy, and they believe that the political establishment doesn't get it. In Germany, many Germans believe the political establishment gets it, and then you have that core group motivated principally by immigration, not by economic conditions, that is moving toward the far right.
Well, just in closing, returning to the notion that many are seeing Angela Merkel as the leader of the free world, she did have recently had a phone conversation with Vladimir Putin, who is sort of positioning himself as the adult in Northeast Asia in terms of tensions between the United States and North Korea, warning about the possibility of nuclear war between the U.S. and North Korea, which many analysts over here, including perhaps the person who knows North Korea's program better than anybody, Sig Hecker, the former head of Los Alamos, who's concerned that we're going to stumble into a nuclear war. Merkel herself, I believe, I don't know whether she's talked to Trump about this, but she's sort of offering up Germany, is she not, as a possible broker since they have diplomatic relations with North Korea?
Yes, she has suggested that Germany would be ready to step in, playing a role similar to the role that it played in negotiating the Iran agreement, where Germany is not a member of the Security Council, but because they're a major player, the most significant power in Europe, Germany kind of steps in and plays that role. And that's all for the best. One, because she's got her head screwed on, and two, if in fact the United States is going off the reservation and for the next 3.5 years is going to be governed by a president who doesn't really get what it means to fashion a world in which liberal democracies hang together, she's got to play that role. And that means that Germany has to get involved in North Korea, in China, in the Middle East peace process, in places that it really hasn't done for a very long time, because we need a Germany that is ready to shoulder more responsibility.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure as always, Ian.
Thank you, Charles. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. And his latest book is How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with a veteran sportscaster about how and why Donald Trump has picked a fight with some of the country's biggest stars in football, basketball, and baseball. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Lipside, who's a longtime sport and city columnist for The New York Times and the author of the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, now out in paperback, and Sports World, An American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for the NBC Nightly News. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lipside.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Robert. And surely what's happening now is pretty extraordinary with the president having this gratuitous and seemingly unnecessary attack on big sports stars in the NFL, in the NBA, and in Major League Baseball. And he's doing it in a way at a time when we've got not only the possibility of a nuclear war with North Korea, that ought to be getting the president's attention, but you've got the aftermath of these hurricanes in Texas and in Florida and in the Caribbean and in Puerto Rico, et cetera. You'd think he had better things to do than be tweeting out insults to some of the most popular athletes in this country.
Yeah, I think it kind of follows his modus operandi. I mean, you've got distraction, you've got his ego, and his manhood is at stake, as it is with North Korea as well. You know, football in particular is the last bastion of faux masculinity in America. And he's accusing it of not being violent enough. But I think it makes absolute sense from his point of view. The question is, this Spartacus moment that he seems to have provoked, the gladiators, you know, stepping up, will it really continue, and will it extend to other people? It's very racial in nature, and it's very masculine in tone. And I think at some point, if it's not a wake-up call to his supposed base, then we are doomed.
Well, it is. You mentioned that he said that NFL football wasn't violent enough and that people were going to be leaving the stands unless it became more violent. He said that in this peculiar campaign speech he made down in Alabama in support of a Senate candidate who may actually lose in the primary to an even more extreme right-wing candidate. But how could Trump not know about the recent awareness about the debilitating effects of CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy?
Well, the only way that he would not be is if he himself is a victim of CTE. I mean, I know we don't want to let him off the hook, you know, as a demented person, as disabled in some way, but that seems to be the only possibility. It's beyond cluelessness. I mean, there's so much of this which makes no sense. The thing that does make sense and that excites me, I must say, is that I personally have been waiting for a very long time for the athletic spring. I've been waiting for athletes who are basically conservative, keep their mouths shut, understand that they have a short shelf life professionally, to really stand up in any kind of meaningful way. And, of course, this started a year ago when Colin Kaepernick kneeled for the national anthem, and it's slowly been building. Soon after that, you know, several members of the National Basketball Association, in particular Carmelo Anthony and LeBron James, you know, made rather mild but pointed statements about white police brutality. But that seemed to have gone nowhere. Then about a week or so ago, a very popular black female ESPN broadcaster, Jemele Hill, called him in a tweet a white supremacist. And there was a lot of noise about that. So we've been kind of building and building to this moment where now he, of course, you know, steps out and is incredibly provocative. And the response has finally been strong and appropriate, you know, all over America. Football players have taken a knee during the national anthem, sometimes with the owners who are particularly conservative and Trump-oriented politically. So I think something really is kind of exciting happening here. And the question is, you know, is it this crazy provocation like going after Rocket Man and starting World War III, or does he have something, you know, interesting in mind to distract us from his failures as president, the Republican failures in policy, and, you know, kind of incite a race war that will keep us busy for a while? I don't know.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Lipside, a longtime sport and city columnist for The New York Times and the author of the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, now out in paperback, and Sports World, An American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for the NBC Nightly News. Well, you referred to a number of the NFL teams that have joined Kaepernick in taking a knee during the national anthem. The Baltimore Ravens at an NFL game in London on Sunday, along with the Jacksonville Jaguars, they took a knee. The Cleveland Browns and the Denver Broncos, the Miami Dolphins, also not the whole team, but several players, and then actually with in many cases almost the whole team, with the exception of just one player. And the entire Pittsburgh Steelers team didn't take the field until the anthem was over.
You know, Ian, I think the Pittsburgh Steelers thing is really interesting because it ties into exactly what sports and football is about, the idea of having this cohesion, the idea that the team must act together as one. And the complaint against Kaepernick, of course, was that he was a divisive factor. So here, in an attempt to avoid divisiveness, the coach of the Steelers keeps everybody off the field during the anthem. So he's made a kind of political choice of his own that he kind of understands which way the wind is blowing. And maybe that's the clue for the rest of us to understand that's what's happening at least among this cohort of very conservative young men, 75% of whom are black. You know, it's one thing that's to keep in mind is that the Trump victory really came out of so many tenets of jock culture, what I call jock culture, trash talk, violence, suppression of women, the creation of the other. Anybody who's not on the team, different color, different ethnic group, different country, is not part of us. And this is how sports has always operated, certainly in this country and other countries as well, of this division between us and them. And he exploited that brilliantly in his political campaign. And now it's snapping back at him. Just those same tenets of jock culture are refuting him. And, you know, that, as I said, that's why I think this is a very exciting moment in history, and I hope it really is an athletic spring and not a Prague spring and kind of goes on.
Well, the tweets are pretty extraordinary and incredibly childish in terms of Stephen Curry. The very popular basketball player in with the Golden State Warriors, he mentioned to a reporter that he wasn't happy with, he wasn't excited about going to the White House, and so what does Trump do? He disinvites him in a kindergarten way.
Yeah, it's childish, but also, Curry has always been part of this, you know, new and more sophisticated generation of athletes. But start looking at the people that he seems to be alienating, who was supposedly on his side, Robert Kraft, the conservative owner of the New England Patriots, perhaps, you know, the best football team, the most popular in many ways, a million-dollar supporter of his inauguration, not to mention all the other donations. Famous coach of that team, Bill Belichick, who publicly endorsed Trump, and Tom Brady, who's, you know, kind of been somewhat ambiguous, although he says that Trump's a friend. He's been ambiguous in his political support. All three of them this Sunday at least, you know, pushed him, distanced themselves from him, thought that they were at the least, quote, disappointed in his tweets and his actions. So does he know this? Does he know that these people are being eroded from his foundation? I don't know. There's so much about him that's so mysterious in so many ways and can only be written off by saying, well, the man's nuts.
Well, he was, of course, at a campaign rally in Alabama. That's a pretty football mad state, is it not? The Crimson Tide and all.
Right.
So, but you're suggesting that maybe you just said he's nuts. There is some evidence, I'm hesitant to talk to psychiatrists about Trump because mentally ill people are by and large decent people, and I don't want to let this man off the hook for his appalling behavior, and for the former senator referred to him as Danforth, Republican senator referred to Trump as a hateful man, and I think that's a reasonable description of him. He seems to be spreading hate and division. There's nothing about being a uniter. He's a divider. Apparently the symptoms of dementia are not being able to finish a sentence, sort of wandering all over, repeating themes, going back to a kind of Groundhog Day speech themes, which he does, and he obviously keeps having these campaigns and relitigating the campaigns. And he led the crowd in Alabama with a lock her up, etc. And also the fact that he can't sleep at night. These are, I believe, symptoms of dementia. But if that's the case, then it's obviously going to get worse, isn't it? I mean,
well, yeah, you've just made a very persuasive case, Ian, I think. So one can only hope that if it gets worse quickly. And so we will be rid of this. You know, this one.
By the way, Robert, we'll be rid of it, but then we'll have Mike Pence, who's a very effective, ultra-conservative, almost theocrat in his religious fundamentalism. And, of course, you know, he's obviously a religious fundamentalist in the Christian sense, but obviously has not really studied the Beatitudes, the Gospel, according to St. Matthew, etc. He's actually quite cruel in his Christian outlook. And the prophet Jesus, of course, was the one that administered to the poor and kissed the lepers, etc. That's not Mike Pence.
There's kind of one other thing in terms of, and we're talking now about a speech in Alabama. Back to the sense of race. I think that in that kind of white-centric place that he's coming from, where a lot of people, and speaking particularly about football players, a lot of people can't understand why these athletes, the professional athletes making millions of dollars a year, can't be just grateful for the opportunity they get here in America and go along. I think that's a mm-hmm. strong sense. And in football particularly, where you have now fantasy football and objectivization of football players who you don't really see all that well because they're wearing all that padding and whose violence really in some ways seems almost cartoonish on television. I think that there's probably something basically valuable for Trump in attacking them, in posturing himself as more of a man than they are, and putting them down in their greed, but as he would see it, as some fans would see it, in their arrogance and greed and lack of gratefulness to American society. This only to kind of give some sort of rationality, ugly, cruel rationality to be sure, but a kind of way of understanding what he might be doing other than just being crazy.
Right. In other words, again, just like Charlottesville, signaling to the far right for reasons which are mystifying. I thank you for joining us, unless, of course, the guy himself is a racist, which is, might well be the only logical
conclusion. There's no question about that. I mean, the government nailed him on that many years ago, early in his career.
Well, Robert Lipson, I thank you very much for joining us and appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Lipson, a longtime sports and city columnist for the New York Times and the author of the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, now out in paperback, and Sports World and American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for the NBC Nightly News.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.